Welcome to Fossils by Firelight, a series of conversations with South Africa's geological legends, where they unearth their discoveries, learnings, memories, interesting stories, and maybe a few tall tales to chronicle our history and inspire the next generation of geological heroes.
Welcome to all the young men around here, and it's not to offend calling you young men. It's because you inspire a lot of geologists out there. We are in the presence of greatness. So welcome again to each and every one of you, including we've got some three past presidents, actually. I just got to say, one of them was a president when I was 1 year old, then the next one when I was 3 years old. And then 10 years later, the same president was president again for a second term. And then
that was Richard.
Yes, I didn't want to mention any names, but then the next Richard. President was it came a year after Richard's second term. So we are in the presence of greatness, as I said. So I am a bit starstruck or rock starstruck, and just thanks again to Solid Gold Studios, the perfect geological setting for some Wits Gold. So I'll hand back over to Nolene to kick off.
So obviously you have been inspired, Sifiso, because you've been a president as well. But I think we're going to start with the person who has been the president most. Richard, why don't you kick off this conversation?
I really appreciate you asking us to this event, which I think is very important. While we're still here and kicking, we can, you know, download some of our knowledge and some of the things that happened. I, in fact, personally worked for four of the major mining groups, the mining houses, as they were called. I've heard them called the Big Seven, the Big Six, the Big Five. But in any event, there were seven at one stage, and now there are none. So I think that story of why there are none is important, and what happens after the big mining groups.
You must understand the mining houses of those days, I don't think there's anything like them today. They were absolutely unique. These were multi-commodity industrial mining companies. And I know Anglovar, all of them had the most amazing empires. There was a time where the six or seven or five or whatever it was comprised about 75% of the capitalization of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. So, and that included food, property, newspapers, breweries, hotel groups, cars, you know, everything that was all owned in the mining companies. And JCI was just an extraordinary place. We had amazing people, scientists of high caliber, and there was always somebody that you could learn something from. We had extraordinary members of the board. And I mean, Ron, Richard, and I all worked for JCI, and we were just reminiscing earlier about Gordon Waddell, who was our chairman for a period of time. And boy, he was a mover and shaker, and he was the first person that, on an executive level, who really recognized the role of and the importance of a geologist. And all good things happened to a lot of us who worked quite hard under his watch.
In any event, I spent something like 35 years of my career with the mining houses, and had a fantastic career with them. And I'll explain briefly some of the events that happened. I think the first thing that comes to mind is the importance, which I'm not sure what the present status is with younger geologists, but we all, during the vacations, would look for vac jobs. Vac jobs are very important. And in this regard, the mining houses were extremely good because they always employed a whole bunch of students for vac jobs. So to give you an example, my very first vac job at the end of my first year in 1958, before all of you were born probably, was with Anglo-American. And I was stationed at the Western Reefs gold mine in the Klerksdorp area. So I arrived in the mine, but before I arrived, they said, no, there's one thing you got to do. So I said, oh, what's that? You got to get a red ticket. Otherwise, there's no ways you can go to a mine. So I thought, what is this red ticket? And you know, I soon really discovered the red ticket was to make sure that you were healthy and that you were able to go underground. So I arrived in the mine. After my first visit underground with a with one of the mine geologists, I realized why I did need a red ticket. It was hot as Hades, and we were perspiring, and I thought, phew, is this the job of a geologist? In any event, it turned out that it was, and the geologist's job was to map underground, to map the geology. And I think that was a seminal lesson. You've got a map. Wherever you are, you got a map. So that was my first vac job. And you also got to know how mines operated. You got to know the other divisions on the mines, the metallurgy, the mining engineering side, and how these different disciplines were integrated and worked together. Very important. So that taught me quite a bit. But the other thing was the social side, which was another story. I won't go into too many details. Except to say that living in a mine single quarters, and I don't know if who ever done that, but it's quite an experience, the characters that you meet. Yeah. But this is important. You've got to understand who you're working with in the mining industry. So that was my first experience, and I learned a heck of a lot, particularly about mapping underground, which stood me in good stead later on.
I've actually felt guilty quite a lot of my life because when I was at Rhodes, I went to study geography and chemistry, and they said to me, you can't do the two together, so why don't you do geology? Now, I'd grown up with an older brother who was a friend of Prof. Alan Wilson, and they were very keen on rocks and things, and so my brother was always bringing these rocks home and talking, and Alan was always talking about it. So I had that background, but it didn't strike me that that was somewhere I wanted to go in the rest of my life. So here I am at Rhodes being told that I can't do what I want to do. I must go and talk to the geology lecturer, Bertie Radock, and go and ask him about geology. And Bertie said to me, look, this is it. You know, you come and do geology. It's lekker. So I did geology. And 6 months into the year, we got a note from the prof about the Chamber of Mines are asking students who would like to do a vac job in geology on the mines. And again, I thought, no, I want to go home and I want to go and see my family. And Larry Newhoff was my big buddy by then. And Larry said to me, Ron, this is it. This is where we're going, boy. So we both applied for a job. I got the job and Larry didn't, which anyway, he subsequently sorted himself out. And I ended up at Rustenburg Platz at the end of the year, and that was it. I was convinced this is what I really wanted to do. And for the next year, I applied again for a vac job at JCI, with JCI, and again asked for Rustenburg Platz, and they said, no, sorry, jobs are taken there. You'll have to go somewhere else. Ended up at Western Areas. Frank, so I can tell you now, Frank, that convinced me of one thing. Richard has mentioned the heat. On one day, I lost 7 kilograms. I promise you. And I didn't have 7 kilograms to lose.
I didn't think much about my own career, but just to back Frank's one comment, my first job was on Free State Geduld, which was a fairly deep, difficult mine in the Free State. And Western Holdings, we did both. And boy, they put us in, maybe I must be careful about this because my family told me I mustn't use the term black or white, but we went into what they called white daily paid hostel. Now, this was very interesting because this hostel was full of, they were mainly European guys out of the Eastern Bloc in Europe who'd come out and they were the miners. They weren't engineers, they just were miners. And I'll tell you, I was in that white daily paid hostel for a while. These guys used to drive motorbikes up the stairs to their room at night and park it next to their bed. One guy used to shoot rockets every night after dinner on the lawn. He would shoot a dozen rockets every night of the year. And there were knife fights in the dining room. it was a remarkable place, I'll tell you. But you did learn the kind of guys you had to deal with underground. And that was a great learning period.
I enjoyed my time at Rhodes, and every long vacation, which was over the December, January, beginning of February period, I would work vacation jobs. The first couple were up in to the north of the Zambezi with chartered exploration, and then the last couple out of Rhodes, I worked in what was then southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and it was a very varied type of work. Small gold mines, mapping, sampling, base metal propositions, industrial minerals, chromatite work on the Great Dyke. Very interesting.
I think all of us, we have a passion for the rocks, and they don't, I was saying to Dirk, they don't move. Well, they do if you mine them, but that's a good end result. But the you can never stop learning. I would still learn something every day of my life around the rocks. I was just underground today at Agnes. I'm managing Agnes Mine in Barberton at the moment. And Richard, we're there, just not, we're mining Biff Hosted right on the Omphafark at Princeton, and we've got Galaxy running, which is the most discreet, interesting, structurally complex. It's probably another million-ounce play there, but we just don't have enough drilling, not enough development. All of those things that the old mining houses did in their sleep to get a junior to put money into exploration, drilling, and development underground these days is very difficult because we've got to pay the bill.
I then eventually did my honors degree and MSc degree at WITS. And my first job after that, after the MSc, was to join another mining house, JCI. And that was in 1963. Soon after that, JCI at that time had become involved in platinum through Rustenburg Platts, which is part of the JCI story. And both Morris and I were then assigned jobs in the Bushveld complex. So from the Witwatersrand now, we both picked up a tremendous experience in the Bushveld complex. I was assigned a job in looking at the nickel pipes west of the Pilansberg and spent some very good time there, and was lucky to have some extremely good mentors. And I think that's another important point I'd like to make. One of the guys there was Frank Vermaak. He was my boss at the time. And he, again, stressed the importance of geological mapping. So, again, hammered into me. So, the other guy that I met there was a field assistant who had been allocated to me, and as part of the exploration, Bill Nairn. And over the years, we became very good friends. And I tried to convince him to do geology. However, he felt that geology was not quite his calling. He studied mining engineering, and eventually he became the MD of JCI in later years. So he had a stellar position, and he became the chief technical director of Anglo-American and Anglo-Gold, subsequently Anglo-Gold. So you may meet these interesting people along the way as well. And Morris, incidentally, at that time, had a mapping job in the eastern Bushveld, and he then was exposed to the Merensky Reef and the mapping of the Merensky Reef, and he became absolutely besotted with the Bushveld.
I was totally convinced that platinum was where I wanted to be if I was going to be a geologist. And sure enough, after several stints at Western Areas, I graduated, and before graduating, I applied to JCI to get a job at Rustenburg. And it just so happened that platinum had just started to come out of one of its many doldrums. And that was a feature of the platinum industry. At the time, it was very small. I mean, Rustenburg Platts mined about 400,000 tons a month. and there was a bit of mining up the road. And of course, there was nobody else. In fact, JCI believed that nobody else could ever mine PGMs, you know, because they were the only ones who had the expertise. So anyway, I ended up at Rustenburg Platz, and it was great for 2 years. We were actually increasing production. So we now had a chief geologist and two operating geologists. So when you talk about mapping, you also need to talk about walking, Richard. I walked underground miles and miles and miles, but I was much happier walking underground in a platinum mine than I would have been in a gold mine. but I fell in love with the Bushveld. And of course, subsequently met Frank Vermaak. He was our group geologist, and Frank had great interest in the origins of the Bushveld and things like that. And of course, there was more to Bushveld than platinum. I mean, you talked about the nickel. That was Vlakfontein, I presume. Yeah. And there was the chromite. So there was all these varieties of things. But that didn't stop the fact that the platinum industry went up and down like a yo-yo for years and years and years. And you didn't know whether you were going to be on the chopping list or you were going to survive, you know. And so it was quite stressful. So back to Gordon Waddell. And this is again how having a mining house, things were different, because the mining house had the strength to allow the platinum division, for example, which was Rustenburg Platz, essentially, that was what it was, to survive. When at one stage, we made 200,000 rand for the year profit. And that was based on nickel, because we were selling nickel as a byproduct. But Waddell came along and said, no, this is enough of this. We need to stabilize the platinum industry. And he went off and made friends with the Russians, who were the ones that were actually screwing it up, because they would sell platinum for nothing just because they could, because they were actually producing nickel. Palladium in those days was a nothing metal anyway. Nobody even heard of it, except the dentists. They used it a lot, and people who wanted white gold. But so Waddell stabilized the platinum industry, and JCI's platinum division started to make inroads and grow, and ultimately it got to the point where it was self-supporting. We didn't have to run to JCI for funding to keep going, and we started developing new mines and opening up the Bushveld, and of course that later became an absolutely essential part of retaining mineral rights. But back then, we were developing because the market was developing. And that market was developed by guys like Waddell and other JCI directors, whereby they convinced the Japanese that platinum looked better on their fingers than gold. So I was going between Rustenburg section and Union section up the road, getting a little bit of advancement as I went along, now fully convinced that I am a geologist, by the way, and no longer doubting anything, and totally obsessed with the interests of the Bushveld. And, of course, along comes guys like Morris, who by then had already fallen in love with the Bushveld. And when you met Morris and you started talking about the Bushveld, I mean, he just carried you away. I mean, he just wanted to know. I mean, you were the guy that was walking underground and mapping and so on more than he could, because he was from head office. But you couldn't tell him enough. I mean, he just wanted to absorb everything. And together we eventually did the paper on Rustenburg. And, of course, he did other follow-ups on all the aspects of the Marensky Reef that hitherto had not ever been discussed, because that was the other thing. In the days of the JCI situation, we, certainly in the platinum division, were not allowed to talk to people from Impala Platinum, which by now had come along, and much to the chagrin of people like Hugh Scott Russell, our technical director, who had said they will never be able to produce platinum. They were a major force. But so we weren't allowed to talk to those guys even, and that later changed, thank goodness. But so Morris was one of the drivers between behind us getting to know more about our own bushveld and about other things.
As Frank said, they learnt the mining game. We did exploration correctly. We didn't make mistakes. We had money because these mining companies, which became 7, 6, 5 of them, they were actually investment houses. They were not just mining companies. Well, the result is they had enough money to stake exploration. They paid for it themselves. They didn't have to borrow any money, which meant that we were spending hundreds of millions of rands every year on our budgets in exploration. The boards were very, very supportive. They didn't mind spending it. I think they listened to us, which we continually said that by mining you deplete your ore reserves and you better replace them. So by spending those hundreds of millions, and everybody was doing it, all our mining companies, although there were some wonderful things. In those days, you didn't tell your opposition anything. Nothing. I can remember crawling around Frank's exploration, and we'd go and park the Land Rover under a tree and take our binoculars and count the rods on the drill rigs to know how deep they were. And it was, life has changed. Today, you put it in the newspaper. It's not the same game at all.
We were both approached in 1965 by Des Pretorius at the Economic Geology Research Unit. And I might just add that the Economic Geology Research Unit, together with the Precambrian Research Unit at Cape Town and the Bushveld Research Unit at Pretoria, were all started because of an organization called the Chamber of Mines. And the Chamber of Mines had a committee that advised them. And this committee consisted of the consulting geologists of the big six or seven or whatever. So this is highly important. And they said, look, we need research in the Bushveld. We need research in the Witwatersrand Rand. And so let's get it going with these units that were formed. And they acted as incredible training grounds for young geologists. And we don't really get those opportunities anymore. But we need to think about that as an important thing, because many people here, I think Frank and I'm not sure if Ronnie was involved at some stage, but were involved with the Economic Geology Research Unit. And I think we learned a hell of a lot.
And of course, one of the things that JCI offered the fundamental research unit and the other departments were these conferences that we, what did we call them? We had a different name for them. But anyway, a symposium sort of thing. And we would get together as a group and present papers. It gave you as an individual an opportunity to do a presentation, you know, in public and on a more academic or a practical level. And to hear what other people were doing and what other people had been doing in the company. And of course, with that multitude of different product commodities, there was the opportunity to move from one to the other. And many of us did. I was far too happy where I was to want to move. And although I came close a couple of times. And anyway, so ended up 13 years on the mines and got to know the Bushveld very well, followed by promotion to head office.
And that really was the beginning of the whole story of commodities, and again, through this whole Upper Mantle project, which was actually orchestrated by the Economic Geology Research Unit, which was got the sanction of the Chamber of Mines. So again, Chamber of Mines played a very important part here in facilitating what one could do at those times. But I think the thing that really stood out was the importance again of geological mapping. And again, this has been extremely important during my career in geology to have that understanding. Everything else fits in later, it's fine, no problem, but you got to understand geology in the field, number one. And I think we were lucky in being given that opportunity.
Richard's talked about the Chamber of Mines. I mean, what an experience that was to sit on that consulting geologist committee and meet your peer geologists from the other groups and talk about common issues of research, and always accompanied by one or two beers. My involvement with the Geological Society probably reached its peak during the times at JCI. They were highly supportive of us undertaking these tasks. And it started off with the Western Transvaal branch. We used to drive down to Potchefstroom, and it was a very dour, conservative bunch of guys at the University of Potchefstroom who used to organize the most boring lectures, and we'd have coffee and biscuit afterwards. And there were, if we were lucky, there were about 10 or 12 people. And I ended up as chairman of that thing, and we moved the venue to the hotel, got sponsors for beer and food, and we were getting 150 people at each meeting. It was a great privilege for me to succeed Richard as president of the Geological Society, and I think during that year, our biggest achievement was the restructuring of the Geological Society into more of a business-orientated organization. And I think the foundations or the principles that we put in place, they're pretty much in place today. And that was 25 years ago, so at least something's worked.
Frank, you've often told me that the best geologist is the one that's touched the most rocks. And I'm sure you've touched many rocks.
Well, it's an interesting comment, because the person who told me that was none other than Professor Des Pretorius. And yes, you know, we were talking earlier, and I mean, he had a formidable presence, Des. He kind of looked like Paul Kruger, and he had a voice that boomed. But before we get on to Des, I'll maybe just give a quick thumbnail sketch of how I evolved into geology. And I was exiled by my parents to boarding school when I was 7, and had the great fortune of having Dr. Tony Brink as one of our housemasters at the school. And he and Tim Partridge became probably the top engineering geologists of South Africa. And Tony talked to me lots about geology, and I had a cousin who was kind of interested. So at the age of 8, you know, you always say to kids, what are you going to be doing? And I said, I'm going to become a geologist. And lo and behold, it did happen. I was at Wits as well, and it was an extraordinary time. I had a fairly prolonged career at Wits, much to my parents' distress. Started in 1967 and ended in 1974. During that period, I had great fortune of being lectured by Professor Tom Clevers. And Tom used to play classical music for the first 10 minutes of every lecture. And he'd turn the dim the lights, and we'd sit in the auditorium in silence listening to this classical music. There are a million stories that can be told about him. There were brilliant lecturers that we had at Wits at the time. It was a really great time. And fortunately, during my honors year, I was looking for a job when we finished the next year. And during the course of that year, I had met Richard and Morris, who had just finished their field work on their PhD. In fact, I think it had largely been written up at that stage. And they'd just become involved with JCI. In fact, it was after you'd finished. And they persuaded me to join the JCI group. Prior to that, I'd worked for about a year in northern Namibia for Texas Gulf Exploration. And that's the first time that I met Ted Grabicki. And we had the most phenomenal boss up there, a fellow called Ned Poole, who was wild. But he was a brilliant economic geologist. So off I went to JCI, and Richard, because of his experience as a student, suggested that I took a job on the JCI gold mines, which I did, and I started my JCI career with at Western Areas Gold Mine. And I remember Des Pretorius saying, God, what a waste. And I said to him, well, you know, I'm going to Western Areas. And he said, oh, that's different. He said, if you can sort out the geology and understand the geology of that mine within 12 months, you're going to be able to work anywhere. And it was a complicated ore body, and it was probably one of the most exciting experiences of my life when in the middle of the night I was having a dream and I could see the mine in three dimensions. And I think that's the big thing about why we always say to young geologists, work on a mine so that you can get this experience of seeing an ore body in three dimensions. There were some really hairy moments on the mine. I'd been there about a month and I got caught in a rock fall and was carried out in a stretcher and spent a few days in hospital. That was quite interesting. And we had a massive underground fire on the mine. The mine burned for a month. It was the largest, longest, most expensive underground fire in the history of the Witwatersrand gold mines. And I did the night shift, and the geologists were right there with the proto teams because we were the only ones who understood the three dimensions of the ore body and how to access places where they could go and fight the fire from. So that was a very interesting time. From the mine, I was then, in fact, we were due to, after we got married, my wife and I, we were due to go back to the mine, and we'd been allocated a house at Hillshaven, which is one of the least desirable places in the world to live. And while we were on honeymoon, I got back and found out that I'd been transferred to Richard and Morris's fundamental research unit. And that was one of the happiest days of my life outside of my wedding day.
I'm sure Kay's too.
And I started a research program, but during that time I was also seconded to the Economic Geology Research Unit at WITS, working under Des Pretorius. And gosh, what a mentor he was. I mean, he's one of those heroes in my life.
We all had our mentors in all those companies we were telling you about. They were the top geologists, and everything I know or knew, I learnt from everybody I worked for. They were fantastic geologists. I don't think we can repeat that easily. So I think a young geologist today must not try and be self-taught, and they all are trying to be self-taught. They should pick up the people they can diagnostically realize are good. They should latch onto them. They should work for them or with them. They should talk to them, because mentors are the most important thing to a young geologist. If you remember that Colin Powell, very wonderful a military guy in the USA, he gave a talk about how to pick people. It was a wonderful talk, and it just meant that if you were going to run a company or your own business, you must employ people that are better than you are. And that was a creed that I carried. I think everybody I employed in all these companies were better than I was. So they were all damn good geologists. And we had, remember Isaac Newton when he wrote that letter, and he said that if he could see further, it was from the shoulders of giants. Well, that's what I'm trying to say. Everybody that I worked with were great giants in geology. And I just hope, and I've lost touch with it, I just hope that there are still great giants in our game.
So that's where the onus is. But passion about rocks, mentorship, geology just gives you such a huge platform. I've traveled into six continents, including Antarctica. What an amazing life. I'm just very thankful for that. I'm thankful for the people I've met who have helped me. And I'm also very much in a mentorship type of phase of my career now, where I just love feeding back into young people as long as they've got enthusiasm. And I couldn't agree with Derek more about coming away from self-teaching to, I think that's because the big thrust that the GCSA can get into is getting our mentors out there, getting maybe the universities. We need to get more aggressive about getting the guys on the ground. That might be an unfair statement, but I'll leave it at that.
One thing I did learn in my career, it doesn't matter what task you're carrying out, always put your maximum energy into it and always make it as interesting as you can. Try and find new angles, new ways of looking at things. There's a lot to be learned from the most humble of people you may be working with. Everyone has got eyes. Everyone has got opinions, and they're all important. Listen to them all and learn. modify their views if you wish, help them to see things the way you do. But often they bring glimpses of truisms or observations that other eyes didn't pick up.
It was also during my JCI time that I met our current president. He just retired from the National Union of Mine Workers, and his office was immediately above mine, and we used to meet in the lift on occasion and so on, and swap niceties. I think towards the end of the great days of JCI, the golden era, I think everybody that's online here would know this, it was the time where Nelson Mandela was being released and the political situation was changing in South Africa. And there were a handful of us, certainly in JCI, that were called apart by the board. And basically we were told to go and find the world and travel the world and look for opportunities. And for, I guess, 2 or 3 years, Ron, you were part of that group, we traveled the world. It was not great for our families, but boy, what experiences. And we developed an international knowledge of people from around a network of note. And gosh, we saw some extraordinary things.
As Frank alluded to, after the last 3 years or so of JCI, we started to do something we'd never done before. And from a platinum point of view, you could understand it. We had 80% of the world's platinum. Why would we want to travel overseas and start finding other platinum deposits? That could only, you know, mess things up. But in actual fact, the convincing point was that what if somebody else did it and you weren't involved? The risks there were greater. And so we started to go with Frank and the boys traveling around the world, Australia, Canada, places like that. And it really changed our outlook on geology, and that is something I would stress for young geologists. To when you get a chance to go somewhere and learn something, to go somewhere exotic even, there were some places I didn't want to go to eventually, but I went. Take the opportunity and go. And again, going back to a company like JCI, they gave you those opportunities, and you had the chance to expand and better yourself and to contribute to other people and to contribute to the group, the greater group. At this point, I get to being AMPLATS, which was September the 1st, 1997, the demise of JCI, which broke our hearts. But after a couple of years and what I saw had happened with JCI Limited, I was so thankful about AMPLATS. And It was a mini JCI. I mean, it carried all the traits that JCI and all the principles that were in JCI. It had all the people.
So those were good times. One of the great sadnesses was the breakup of the JCI group in the unbundling. We understand the political reasons for that. And very sadly, JCI Limited, which came out of that, had a very, you know, an unfortunate demise through the misadventures of our chief executive. And I was at a bit of a loose end of what to do. 1998 wasn't a good time to be unemployed. The mining industry was in dire straits. And the greatest fortune happened is that my old friend Derek Kyle came back into my life. And he and Colleen had just set up a company called the Mineral Corporation, and they'd been working together for 6 months. And I think Derek maybe was just getting a little bit ear-bashed by Colleen, and he needed some male company around the place. So he and I went and had lunch at a very nice restaurant in just near Hillbrow, believe it or not. And by the time we got to the main course and the wine was finished, he'd offered me half the company, and then we got stuck into the liqueurs, and we shook hands, and he and Colleen diluted down to 20% and picked up a pro rata share of the loan account, and so the Mineral Corporation was born.
He pinched all those shares from me over lunch, but he He wasn't telling the truth, I can tell you, because we didn't quite go down to 20%, Colleen and I, but Frank certainly got a big whack.
And I had 24 years with JCI, and I was 21 years with the Mineral Corporation, 22 years.
Wow.
So, I think probably one of the exciting things in my life is the people that I've met. And goodness gracious, I mean, it's from kings and queens and presidents and prime ministers and ministers. And I mean, we did a job for Prince Andrew when he was he had a decent reputation. And it was for Trade Partners UK, and we presented the findings in the UK. And he came out to South Africa after that, and the High Commission phoned me from Hyde Park and said, he's coming, would you come and meet him to talk about the project? So I was quite excited about this. So off we go, and my wife's with me, and he asked me about the project, and I spent about 4 minutes telling him, and he said, no, that's very interesting, thank you. And then he turned to my wife and said, and what do you do? So she said, well, I play golf. He said, me too. And that's the last I talked to him.
And did they go play golf?
No, they didn't, yeah.
So all of you have had long careers and many years in one company. And Derek, I know you have.
I'm a bit older than these guys, and I worked in the mid to late 50s. And I worked in Central Africa, and I worked in the Zambezi area. We were in field camps of the day, but I might just tell you that's, I also worked for groups that was before their time. I worked for Central Mining, which was the biggest gold mining company in Johannesburg at one time. They bought Rand Mines, and I worked for Rand Mines for 10 years. Remarkable companies with remarkable geologists. The best example, it's on my wall somewhere here, is Bill Borchers' stripping the overlying rocks to the bits. The two maps, the one with the overlying rocks and the ones without. And that was presented, I think it was 1961, it's one of the big conferences. He was a great geologist. We had other great geologists in Rand Mines. Anyway, I worked for them in Central Africa and in the Zambezi Valley. In fact, we were the first people to put a camp up at Mana Pools. And nobody had ever been there. It was a tsetse fly area. There were fly gates, and people weren't allowed in. But we went in. We were looking for copper, and we found it. In fact, we found a deposit which we sold to Lonrock. But we worked there for 4 years. Interesting times. No fridges, no radios, and no roads. And that was a distance of about 200 kilometers down to the Mozambique border. And we spent 4 years on our feet. We had fly camps. We had porters. And every Monday morning from a fly camp, we used to head off with about 25 porters. We'd work, map, sample the streams. And at about 4 o'clock, we'd carry definitely the old-fashioned cook boy and all the equipment. And he used to set up a camp every night at 4 o'clock. And we used to go and fish and shoot guinea fowl. And we used to shoot for the pot for those 4 years. We fed in the field probably 20 or 30 laborers at a time. When we found the deposit, which the old Shamrock mine, we had 200 Shangaan contract workers. And we looked after them. There were no other whites in the area. Nobody was allowed into the area. It was remarkable to work under those conditions. When you think of what the modern guys have with communications and fridges, and all the temperatures were well over 100 degrees at times in the hot valley. Anyway, that was a wonderful time of our lives. Rand Mines was a great company, but it suffered the same fate as JCI. It just sold all its assets, and it just broke up. And then after that, one realized that yes, there were seven mining companies at the time. And then we moved to other groups. We worked with other groups. But what actually happened was that I decided that for my sins, I would form a consulting company. And we joined up with Aircraft Operating Company and the Hunting Group of London, and we formed Hunting Geology and Geophysics Limited. But the big thing was, being part of AOC, we developed in this country the first time a remote sensing. And we developed an expertise with Hunting Geology and Geophysics of photogeology. And that was a remarkable breakthrough in this country. I was consulting geologists for some 20 years, then became a new business director of Anglo-Bohr Mining. And then I retired at the age of 60. And that's when we formed the Mineral Corporation. And then Colin and I actually retired again. That was my second retirement. And after some 8 or 9 or 10 years. And we then decided that that time at Mineral Corporation was probably the end of all the hard work. And so at the age of something like, I think it was 71 or 72, I went on my own. But now that was wonderful because I started to work for small mining companies doing field mapping, controlling drilling, and it was brilliant to get back into the field to actually look at the rocks. It was the most fantastic 7 or 8 years.
Phil, you've got loads of experience in small mining companies, but I think you also worked for some bigger ones.
Keep in mind, my early graduate life was in New Zealand, and my career really took off when I came across to South Africa, and I look at it from, I did a master's in New Zealand, and I was working with Franco Perano, who eventually came to take over Bob Mason's course at Rhodes. Hmm. And Franco was my mentor. And to Derek's point, and you know, he was just absolutely amazing. And I subsequently, he really taught me how to, what I say, think big. And then by nature, I'm a fastidious geologist in terms of attention to detail. So I had this dichotomy of really big thinking, understanding plate tectonics, that type of stuff, right down to thin section work. And my first master's was actually discovered a brand new undiscovered Gryson tin tungsten system in New Zealand. And we were working on that bigger picture, and then he eventually departed. Franco encouraged me to come to Grahamstown. And I saved up enough money to, because yeah, in those days, I call it a zombie course, because you do 2 years work in one year. And in 84, I did exactly that. And you'll recall Hugh Eales was running the department there. A really amazing facility, just Goonie Marsh, the platinum research, all of these things. And then I had Franco. And here's me coming from what I call the young rocks. I knew all about volcanoes and glaciers and anything younger than 600 million years old. I was pretty sharp on it. But show me what a 3 billion year old conglomerate or what Archean rocks were. I'd never seen them. So the move over to here was just absolutely mind-blowing for me. And that year was very formative. In as much as you probably all aware, we cover a lot of ground. The bushveld was just, I struggled to cope with the bushveld, the immensity of the mineral system. I struggled with the getting my mind around the vits. And in latter years, I was put to the test mining it eventually. Not like you guys early on. It was not that long ago with the Great Basin Gold, and I was probably, God had intended that I had to have some vits put onto me so to complete my cycle. But what I can say is his mentorship and then the exposure to these minerals and really fueled my, if I can call it my own intrigue, and my own intellectual capacity to get into what I call applied geology. When I was at Rhodes, that's where I met Mark Bristow. And Mark was doing his PhD, and he'd come and do X or F probe work fairly late at night because there was no drain on the power from the Grahamstown people cooking meals and stuff like that. And I was doing my normal 18-hour day crunching stuff out. And we got to know each other very well, running, playing squash, and he was with Rand Mines in the platinum sector at that stage. And then it's interesting, a few names came up. Frank, when I finished Rhodes, the guy who employed me was Ted Grabitsky, and he picked me out. He said, I've got a job for you, and I'd run out of money by then, so I was really overwhelmed. I said, no, come, you can work. We've got a few projects. So I ended up, as it turned out, at Krustkop in the Pilgrim's Rest area, and subsequently, a couple of years after that, I joined Rand Mines, 86. 1st of April, 86, for April Fool's Day, and that was the beginning of another sojourn, a little bit akin to you guys in JCI, but I was younger than you, and I remember the unfolding of the Rand Mines group as a whole, and you'll all be aware that what came out of that was the Rand Gold and Exploration Gold Division. But prior to that, we had our consultant was a guy, Louis Christ, and he pulled me in one day at Corner House and said, they used to call him Squeaky because they had a very high-pitched voice, probably a lot higher than mine. But he said, Phil, I've got a job for you. Just go over to that cupboard in the corner of his immense office, which was about 10 metres away. And inside it was a huge pile of documents. And I said, so, sir, what do I need to do? He says, grab all that stuff and go away and tell me what you're going to do. And it turned out they'd done a JV with De Beers on all the TCL farms, which is over 900 farms, mostly in northern Transvaal at that stage. And De Beers had done loam sampling, and they'd taken a sample for Rand Mines on every single loam spot in their ground surveys. So I went off, had a look at this, and I thought, my golly, this could be interesting. Big picture, what are we going to do? He said, well, we've got to make a plan if we're going to sell the TCL farms or not. I said, you can't do that. Surely not. He said, well, we've already sold to JCI the platinum. I said, yeah, I suppose you must be joking. You've just given away the family jewels, right, Frank?
Yeah, and absolutely
so he
true.
Said, well, tough. We've had lunch with Warren Kula and the deal's done. And so go and have a look at this. You've got 4 days and I want to know what you want to do. So it turned out that they, for every sample, they owed us a 36-element XRF analysis. And that's what I went to De Beers and they did it for me. It was 5.6 million rand of multi-element geochemistry. And that, the reason I bring it up is that was when we started this applied geology thrust of mine, which is integrating geoscience data. And we had no software. I had Willow Steer and Andy Clay, who had worked amazing work on the FITS sedimentology and had actually gone a long way to computerizing and getting into creek estimations, et cetera, et cetera. All we had was Emil Verder, our group geophysicist, who had a software package called Geosoft. And we panel-beta Geosoft to work for geologists, contouring, and away we went. So we ended up with, I think it was 11 joint ventures on the properties, and we kept the Pilgrim's Rest Goldfield going on the back of that work. And it was the first time that we really put, I had some really sharp geos working with me, and we started looking at that. And then the breakup came, and then you'll remember Rand Gold and Exploration had the five old ladies, Blafa, Harmony, the RPPM, DRD, and we had Buffles. So I was summoned to, from the field, effectively Zinnine at that stage into Joburg, and I was told you joining Mark Bristow. I said, oh, okay, what's going on? He said, no, new company, and away you go. So they pulled me in as the non-FITS geologist, and you guys may well know Adrian Reynolds, in particular, steered the geological input. But we were a bunch of young geos, mavericks, really, at that stage, and we were being mentored well, Derek, very well, but we also had this sort of a very, very strong push to do something new in the South African geological circle. And without going into the Keble situation, we ended up with the takeover of Rangoldan Exploration, and the infamous Peter Flack became the chairman. And there's a little story here, and I don't know if all of you know how Rangoldan Resources came to be, but Peter Mark Bristow had been at Peter Flack to try and sway the vote for eventually the takeover, and we failed. So Peter Flack told him, said, listen, I've got to talk to you. I actually want to fire you and your team, but is there anything you want to say? And Mark said, I need an hour with you, Peter, with my team, and you'll change your mind. And he said, oh, you must be joking. Are you testing my sense of humor? So there was duly arranged this meeting. And to lay the scene, we'd been working really hard trying to organize our life with the assets that we had at Rangoldan Exploration. But we had also said, listen, you guys, it's time to break out of South Africa and grow and get into other terrains, and gold in particular. So this meeting was set up, and funny as it was, Ted Grabitsky was sitting across the table, Vaughan Armstrong, I remember, and Peter, and then there was Mark, myself, and Adrian, and Dave Ashworth, who was our CFO at the time. And we started this meeting, and we painted a strategy, a growth strategy, for Rangoldan Resources to grow through acquisitions in East and West Africa, and to grow into an exploration company that would potentially, depending on the quality of its exploration success, become a miner. And just to cut to the short, we an hour and a half later, we pulled out a case of Castles, and we were informed that we had 16 million rand a year to work with, which was the interest of a loan we had from Rand, and that was what we could grow Rangoldan Resources from. And off we went. And there's a remarkable story around all of that, but one of the main areas was Brett Keble decided to buy BHP Marley without any board resolution, and it cost us around about $80 odd million, which I'm not quite sure where he found that money, because we were not making money. And one of the intricacies of BHP Marley was they had a site called Lulo, which is in Western Mali down from Kais. We had a Siama mine which was running, but what we found was the egg in the basket took a little while to surface, and it was called Marilla. It was just an absolute ridiculously amazing ore body. And I was the first geologist to properly log. We only had 14 holes, and I went and logged them, and the gold there was like a pepper shaker all the way down core. I'd never seen anything like it in my life, and I dare say most people who came to see Marilla, if you had that luck, you would never see that again. And they've never found another one like it today. They've thrown the book at it. But that set up Rangoldan, you know, the story now, they're still going strong as ever.
Speaking of throwing the book at all these deposits and big exploration budgets, I'd like to now bring in Roy into the conversation from the Anglo days before they, you know, pulled out from all those big exploration projects using all those cutting-edge techniques.
I had a fascination for geology and minerals from early childhood, having had the advantage of watching drilling operations on my home property. My family moved to a small holding on a ridge of greenstones about 15 kilometers northeast or east-northeast of what is now Harare in Zimbabwe. And as a small child, I watched my parents bring in geophysicists and drilling machines and boring and blasting wells to locate water. They didn't have water on the property. They were on the hill. And with great fascination, as an eight-year-old, I had the advantage or the opportunity of studying geology at high school on those field trips that I made with the small group of schoolboys. We went out with people of the ilk of Dr. Ben Vorst, the guy who put together the geology of the Great Dyke of Zimbabwe. And we went on field excursions to the Great Dyke, looked at the chrome seams and seams and other phenomena, and we had a lot of fun. I then went off and decided, under the persuasion of my father, to put my toes in the water to see if I really would like to pursue a career in geology before I committed at university. And I joined a group of explorationists known as Chartered Exploration, based in Lusaka. And that taught me survival, because we carried out our work in the Zambezi Valley escarpment area to the sort of northwest of what is now Kariba, all the way basically from a place called Ibwe Munyama near Chirundu on the Zambezi, down to the Gwembe River, which comes in quite a long way up Lake Kariba. And our work took us daily from the top of the escarpment down to the bottom on foot, and then back up to the top with three or four helpers. And we went back to the top of the escarpment to rejoin our porters. Each small team had about 20 porters to carry the equipment for the night's fly camping, taking food and provisions and sampling materials and mattocks and things needed for the daily work on their backs. And they stayed on top of the escarpment, and we who were doing the sampling and mapping, going up and down the dongas and gullies on the escarpment through the buffalo beans and through the buffalo herds in the Zambezi Valley and up to the top, would meet them at a pre-arranged destination where hopefully they'd set up a camp. Usually about four times out of five, we'd find them where we thought they would be, and occasionally we didn't find them and slept the night in the open. But it was a wonderful experience, and one really learned survival and independence that way. I came back from Rhodes at the end of 1965, coincident with UDI, declared by Ian Smith's government. And it wasn't very long after that I was out in the field again in the Urungwe, south of the Zambezi, with Anglo-American. So for the next 10 years, I varied between doing army stints and keeping my eyes open for mineral evidence and learning the geology of the country as much as I was looking for other kinds of mines. In 1977, I moved south to South Africa. It wasn't possible to continue working in the field in Zimbabwe. The situation was very difficult, to put it mildly. And I became involved in uranium exploration in the Karoo, based at Beaufort West, with Anglo-American, very different sort of line of business. But it taught me new skills. The Peru took me until 1977 when I moved up to Windhoek in Namibia, still with Anglo American. And I became involved running the exploration because the country manager in that country was ill at the time in Johannesburg. And I took over a project ranging from the Koga land in the north to the Spergebied in the southwestern part of the country, right down near the Orange River. And it was in the Spergebied that I worked with a very good team of people, and we discovered the scorpion oxide zinc resource. It took about 10 years before we could convince, or I could convince Anglo that oxide zinc was indeed a worthwhile commodity to extract zinc from. Moved to Johannesburg in 1983 to Anglo's head office, where I worked directly with the late Louis Kutsi. I succeeded him when Louis literally died in the saddle in the office passage in the corridor outside my office. That was the beginning of a very interesting 12 years of my career, where I had the good fortune to manage Anglo's base non-Witwatersrand and non-diamonds and non-coal exploration in southern Africa and expand it across Africa as Africa opened up to the former pariah state of South Africa. I recall very well a trip I made with the late Adrian Versfeld into southwestern Angola. I went up to Luanda a few days after the first signing of the first peace accord between Sam and Joma's group and the prevailing guys who were running Angola at that stage out of Luanda. The civil war was ended by signature of a piece of paper, and within a few days we were in Luanda, and we went out to the old Portuguese core yards, geological survey offices on the eastern side of Luanda. These things had been left to become overgrown by elephant grass and termite trees. There were mealies growing in the passageways between the blocks of buildings. Anyway, we managed to get into the rock library, the rows and rows of wooden drawers with termites creeping up, and a lot of the drawers were eaten. But in amongst this mess, we managed to find quite a few rock samples that were still identifiable by numbers. The Portuguese geologists who collected these over previous decades before the war. So we went straight to the section on ironstone sinking. Aha, that's where we're going to find gossans and evidence of sulfide mineralization. So we sampled those that looked sufficiently interesting, and on the results of those, we identified gossanous material with elevated nickel copper values from an accessible part of Angola, in southwestern Angola. We did a reconnaissance trip down there with some security people from the Angolan army, and it was quite an interesting trip because a lot of the journey was made off track, off road, because there were still landmines in the old tracks and wrecks and vehicles and bits of Cuban military material scattered everywhere. There we managed to get access further north in Africa, picked up rumor of an interesting prospect starting to develop in Mali, We flew a very circuitous route up through Nairobi and Addis Ababa and then across to through to West Africa, then north to Mali, and eventually landed at Kai, where we were met by a Canadian who was contract drilling for some interesting people who held the mineral rights of what is now Sadiola, or became Sadiola, 100 kilometers south of Kai. Some of you will know that area quite well. And it was just a dirt track down, and we stayed overnight at the Sadiola camp, which comprised two containers and a tent in the sweltering heat. Had a look at this prospect, and my eyes nearly popped out at this bland clay, sticky muck, which was carrying these extraordinary gold values. There was very, you know, virtually nothing to see in the actual material, this soft, gunky stuff coming out of the drill cores, which had to be dried on charcoal fires and carefully handled, keep it out of rain or water because it just washes away. Very different sort of rocks. And we brought Sadiola into the fold. I was also involved at one stage in another unusual discovery. During the period when base metals were badly depressed, and I think all the mining houses were wondering what to do with their staff and budgets had been slashed, Louis could see decided we should be looking at gas in the Karoo. And this is a pretty nebulous sort of target, but we went out and we brought in a couple of advisors again, bring in the best people you can. We brought in technical consultants from Texas. Where else do you go? And we learned a lot, and we looked at fracture densities and all sorts of things in and the sub-Karoo structures, and drilled a few holes in the Lindley-Heilbronn area, and we discovered a very unusual helium gas resource on a farm called St. George.
Thanks to all our speakers for all their stories and interesting learnings as well. So with that, we'll be back for more drinks with our fossils by firelight.
I'd like to just stop with the last sentence out of Derek Kyle's book, which in chapter 20 he talks about the mining corporations and the mining houses in Southern Africa. And he says, "I've been privileged and in awe of being part of all of this, albeit as a Johnny-come-lately. Myself and Sifiso, we both feel that we are Johnny-come-latelys, but we've learned so much, guys. Thank you very much."
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.